3, 2, 1.
Here we go! Happy Freak Friday! Grab your beer, strap in. Today we're talking about RFPs. We are going to get down and dirty and have a real talk. I've got a shipper for you who y'all know is a freight godfather. He's been on the show many times. We are going to get some insight from him on RFPs. I've got a trucking and logistics executive. I've got a data guy for you. We're going to dive in, and I want to talk about today whether RFPs are really helpful. Are they useful? Do we need them? They're a pain in the ass. Everybody hates them. But what are the alternatives? And what is the reason for these RFPs? Today's episode is brought to you, thankfully, to our sponsors. We have JJ Keller, who y'all know is my favorite consulting group. So for my trucking companies out there, if you need help with ELDs, hiring, firing, managing drivers, if you need help with hazmat, anything that has to do with regulations, safety, all that jazz, just call JJ Keller. They have consultants all over the industry. They're from Wisconsin, but they have them all over the company, all over the country. So they are your experts. Also, our other favorite sponsor is OTR Capital. I want to make sure that I'm emphasizing today, and I've said this a couple times to my brokers out there, you can use OTR Capital for factoring. So don't forget that you're just as welcome to factor with OTR Capital as carriers. And I don't think shippers factor. I have no idea. I'm going to just leave that to the OTR to say. But I like OTR Capital because they don't play games. They support and have passion for their carriers and their brokers. They offer back admin support. So reach out to your OTR folks. Today, they should be in the crowd. So I'm excited to get started. And this is truly going to be a learning opportunity, even for me, from a lawyer's perspective with RFPs. I've been involved because they require a lot of contracts to be signed, a lot of, if you work for a publicly traded company, you have to disclose a lot of financial information on RFPs. So I've been involved, but I have a lot to learn. So I brought on a co-host, who's Michael Caney. You guys all know him. He's going to help us get through this topic. Michael, can you be the first person to introduce yourself? And wait, where are you? Because you look like you're outside, maybe in a in a nice sunny area.
I'm in my office at home after after a fun 7-hour drive that should have taken me 5. But hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be back. I have a lot of hot sports opinions on this topic, but I probably have more ignorance than I do knowledge because I honestly don't understand RFPs anymore. But I'm glad to be here. I run a 3PL and I do a little bit of advisory on the side. Try to keep it pretty simple. So. I'm actually more excited to talk to Ron because I just always get to interact with him on the comments. And so finally we get to talk a little bit in real life.
Ron, I have to tell you that we were a little disappointed about you being on the show, mainly because, not because of what you think it is, but you tend to be reasonable with RFP discussions, more reasonable than the standard shipper, I think. You have a ton of experience in the industry working for very large companies. I worked for you in my past, and I think, is there a cat? Yes, there's a cat. Actually, Ron, how about you introduce yourself while I try to get rid of this cat?
Keep the cat. It's a fat cat, though. I'm Ron. I've been on the shipper side for about 30 years. As Cassandra said, I worked for some big companies, very big beverage companies. Now I'm working for a mid-sized California-based company that's all flatbed. So I've gone from reefers and vans to all flatbed. As Cassandra says, I don't like RFPs, but I do tend to try to be a little bit calm about it as opposed to other things.
Yeah, you do.
Michael said, see my comments. Sometimes I get wound up. I'll try to be nice today.
Don't try. That's the one thing we love about you is that you'll tell us the truth and you're not afraid of it. And you kind of see through some of the bullshit in our industry. And I appreciate that. Dean, you are new to Mad Metropolis, but not really, because you've been with us in the comments. You've watched us you from the since the beginning. We are really excited to have you.
Thank you.
And please introduce yourself. And there's a rumor going around that you are a Red Sox Patriots fan. So I'll let the comments and Bruins. Hockey's a good sport. Yeah. So Vitaly will like that. Celtics, that's basketball.
Yep.
Basketball.
Yeah, thanks for great to be on here. Thanks for having me, Cassandra. Dean Croak's my name. I'm a freight market analyst, so I spend most of my days understanding what drives demand for the freight we haul, understanding that trucking doesn't create demand. It's derived from a transaction that they have no control over. So I spend most of my time trying to understand what consumers are doing, what manufacturers are doing, what's happening here, what's happening overseas. I spent most of my life in Australia driving trucks, so I've spent a lot of time on shipper docks. In fact, I think I spent about a third of my life on shipper docks waiting for that annoying red light to turn green. And that's if you've ever done that, you'll know it's one of, as a driver, it's one of the most frustrating experiences. And because you want to drive, you don't want to wait. Like you join the industry to drive, not to sit around and wait. So that sort of is a big part of the RFP process that I think gets ignored. So I'm looking forward to the discussion.
I'm excited to have you here too. And you have a great accent. You have a lot of substantive knowledge as well to add, but I mean, I love the accent. So it gives variety to me into the show. Michael Caney, my co-host, where do you want to start off? Do you want to start off with the history? What do you want to do?
Yeah, so
you tell us.
I think as we were talking yesterday and watching the, that is the comment section of the event posting.
Yes,
and I'm gonna pitch it to Ron and Dean because, like I told Dean yesterday, Dean he uses a lot of data, which is different than sentiment or emotion. And so, my belief is that when people talk about RFPs, while most people have a long history of dealing with RFPs, a lot of the recent commentary has a lot to do with this like bullwhip effect that we've been suffering since 2018. Ron, if you want to bring 2016 into it, come on, man.
But
I think, right, it's worth bringing up that you had a softer 2017, you had this insane 2018, you've had weather events and COVID. And so I don't think procurement events have not been the way they normally go historically. That's what I would say. And I think it's worth a discussion to kind of talk about how we got here. And so whoever wants to take that first, either Dean or Ron, I think that's a worthwhile discussion.
Well, Dean, do you want to take the 2018 to 2021? And then Ron will tell us why he loves 2016 just for people who aren't new. And this is important, y'all. So wake the fuck up. Listen.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So I'd go back a little bit further. You know, 40 years ago, we had deregulation, right? And
Dean. Come on.
Yep.
But that created all of this uncertainty for shippers trying to find carriers in all these lanes, right? So, so you know, fast forward to 2016, which was, I think, the last freight recession that we had in my recent memory anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But then we came into 2017, which there was a few things happened late in that year, a couple of big Cat 5 hurricanes. A lot of that led demand for flatbed into early 18. We had changes in the tax code, accelerated depreciation. We had a oil rally, and we had a lot of economic stimulus pumped into the economy. So 18 was essentially a flatbed rate rally, driven rally. So capacity was really tight in flatbed and I was tracking the rates. They were above contract for the first 6 months of the year. And interestingly, flatbed rates have just turned above contract for the first time in years this month. So that was 18. And of course, orders follow price. Carriers think when they're making money, it's a good time to buy equipment. And of course, that year we saw record numbers of new trucks and trailers ordered. 2019 demand tapered off, rates fell, overcapacity hit the market when all those trucks came out in the middle of 2019. And then, of course, it looked like a lot of the industry was sort of shedding capacity if I looked at fleet sizes and trade cycles into January, even into February of 2020. And then, of course, the pandemic hit, and then we've been on this roller coaster ride ever since. But essentially, we have these freight market cycles that seem to go every 3 years, typically. But in the last year, it looks like, or it feels like, we've had three or four freight cycles in 12 months, given where we've been. So that's kind of the short of it.
Three or four freight cycles in 12 months and a typical procurement cycle of 12 months. Or what you said, you know, three or four inside of 12 months and a typical procurement cycle Shippers ideally want it to go for a year, ideally.
Right. And that's why we've seen an acceleration of these mini bids during this whole year.
Yeah.
You know, essentially it's anything that's not an annual RFP has been called a mini bid. But on the on our shipper side of our business, we're seeing a much higher frequency of shorter RFPs on limited lanes, very short implementation cycles. And, you know, this rush to guarantee capacity has sort of been the driving force. But that was the dominant thing that we saw in the last 12 months.
Ron, thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like listening to what Dean is saying is probably what every shipper wants to talk about during an RFP, but rarely gets talked about. As shippers, and this is, you know, we in general are pretty bad at structuring RFPs, not because we're dumb, but because the purpose it serves is too broad to put into context exactly what Dean just said. So I, as a shipper, whether I'm doing, 10 million or 100 million a year, I push it before the budget. I generally just send out all of my lanes to my 1 or 5,000 carriers and just ask for bids. And then I try to clobber them all together, send it off, and then I put together my budget and I award bids or I don't ever talk to you again. But what's interesting is I'm doing it typically from one side, which is to try to create a P&L that I can sign off for with my department and that the CFO ultimately will approve.
Right.
As opposed to what Dean just went through, which is amazing to me, is that unless you do something unusual, and you know, unusual, completely trust your core carrier group or whatever it is, or if you do something like Cassandra and I were part of several years ago, you don't have all the insight that Dean just brought up. And how do you take industry insight with some predictive analysis, wrap that into an RFP so that you can work as partners with a, this is how I'm going to do it versus a, I'm going to win a bid to drive profit for my company and I'm going to try to drop costs for my company, which is typically what RFPs end up being, which makes it pretty complex and ultimately not too damn rewarding.
Yeah, I had a, Ron, I'd like to comment on this. I had a shipper tell me one time when I was young in my career and I was trying to sell to him and I said something about saving money and he said, well, don't save me money, help me control my inflation rate.
Yep.
Because if you save me money, then somebody's going to expect you to save me money again and you can't. Help me control the inflation rate. There's been a couple of comments around what's an RFP, right? And so I think Ron brought it up really well.
Thank you.
So RFP, right? Request for proposal. Now, that can be annual. It can be a mini bid. It can be, and look, Ron will affirm this. Some carriers, some shippers don't bid out their whole network ever. They have $20 million that's dedicated or they have, like, it's different. But the commentary I think that people want to talk about is what Ron just brought up is what's really the effectiveness and what's the purpose? And what does it cost? Hmm. And when I think about cost, Dean, you just brought up freight cycles, right? One of the interesting things about an RFP, and we just hired a technology leader at our company, and his background is warehousing that I was talking to him today. He said, RFPs are the stupidest thing I have to participate in, and I wish they would go away. And this is a guy that's done it for SIVA and FedEx and Genco and big companies. Because the cycles are so long. So especially in transportation, right, Ron, you may go out, depending on the size of your freight spend, you may go out in October, right? And carriers are going to bid things with recency bias. And you may not award that until February or March. All the while, not maybe not you specifically, but a lot of RFPs, right? And so you have 6 months of networks that are operating and carriers that are making bets on a roulette wheel going, well, if I get this from Ron, and if I get this from Anheuser-Busch, and if I get this from this broker, and if I get this from that broker over a 4, 5, 6 month period. And so when you were talking, Ron, one of the things I thought about is something that our friend Andrew Silver talks about a lot, which is trust. I think at the core of the RFP process is, I don't trust you. Because when the market gets hot, you're going to raise all your rates. And the broker, the carrier says, well, Ron, I don't trust you either, jackass. As soon as the market gets soft, you're going to ask me for a rate decrease.
Right.
So I'm just going to pull a pin on that son of a bitch and let you guys have it. Like,
or I'm not going to ask. I'm just going to stop tendering you loads and go to everybody else that's cheaper because I don't have the bond.
Right.
Until the routing guide falls apart and I call you back.
Exactly. So we both take profit when we can.
Yeah. Right. So thus the effectiveness of the RFP, like what's important to talk about? I mean, what should change? Because I think essentially what happened is when Excel spreadsheets and email came out, somebody was like, you know, I have a great idea. We'll just email everybody and get a bid and compare them all. And we've just been compounding that for the last 20 years.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead, Cassandra.
No, I was just actually going to ask another question, Ron, which is, this is a really basic question, but do you and your team sit there and compile all of those ridiculous spreadsheets with the 1 million questions?
Oh, yeah.
Go through them all? Oh, my
yeah,
God. Yeah, I think
so. You know, RFPs, just as the functional process, because it's got a, especially for a publicly traded company, but even for a big private company, I mean, it's filling a lot of needs within one document. And the problem is, and Michael just said it, you know, for 20 years, it's been done a way, and it could be 50 years. Freight at the end of the day is a service and a commodity. And when companies buy those from other vendors, they don't do it the same way. So freight has become abnormal and weird. And those of us that are dealing with transportation, but dealing with other commodities can go, why the hell do we deal with this one uniquely and in a way that just isn't functional compared to other things you have to buy? And it's, I think it's part realistically, and actually Dean mentioned the deregulation from 40 years ago, the fact that there's 500,000 potential carriers in the United States, and that's not even including brokers and everything else. It's a hell of a lot of competition and competitors and folks where if I'm buying cans, and I know Cassandra, I brought this up a couple times, there's like four companies in the US I can buy cans from. They can be more systemic and a better process that when I talk to them, they can give me a level of detail about what is going on at the ingot mines in China that transportation companies can't do. And I do truly think it's almost collective idiocy on the part of the shipper and the carriers that they haven't figured out a more data-driven, smart way to talk about what's coming up either the next quarter or the next year in a way that recognizing there's a lot of volatility, and we're not going to talk about, you know, whose fault it is that rates are what they are. But if you can at least understand why it's moving the way it's moving and what's driving it, exactly what Dean said, then you can have some smart trust-based conversations versus let me take mine when I get me mine and you take yours when you take it. And we're obviously pissed off until it's time for the annual carrier meeting. And then we all go golfing and drink too much beer.
Yeah. And I realize that some of that's an oversimplification, right, Ron? Like not everybody's doing that. And I want to say that there's some shippers out there that are really smart about how they think about working with their carriers. But there is a lot of like, you know, let me ask you this. Do you think it's reasonable to say shippers should have a better understanding of the way motor carriers operate and what it actually costs to run a motor carrier? Or should you, or would you say that's not my problem, that's your problem?
No, I think that's interesting, but I think the understanding it, and I do truly think that most shippers do understand it.
Okay.
And this is where I think it's going to get kind of screwy, because if you look at the cost to own and operate a fleet, the variance in cost, and it's increased the same as it costs to operate a business, because insurance goes up, labor rates go up, fuel goes up. Those impact non-transportation businesses as well. The cost variances over the last decade is completely out of line with the rate variances and weather. So I think it's interesting to know it because it gives me a baseline. As much as I think that a carrier should understand, or a broker should understand, that me as a shipper, what are the drivers to my cost? So that when we sit down, you can do a, hey, you know what, for me to run my fleet and to drive a profit, I need to be at this. And like, well, understand that my new markets, my innovation, my sales projections for the year, those are the costs that I'm looking at. And then we can come to something that makes some sense. I mean, it's done well. With trust, it's a two-way street. And I think there can be some real advantages to those kinds of conversations that typically don't happen today.
I think one of the things that becomes problematic around that, Ron, is when people, and I had this conversation with some folks in the comments the other day, is people think about labor, tractor expense, you know, fuel. They try to, you know, but there's really a, So there's a big cost to network disruption, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so things that disrupt your network are when, whether you're, and the fact that the majority of fleets are 20 trucks or less. I mean, that's just a statistical truth, right? And so if what really impacts a carrier in a big way is driver turnover, the expense of keeping that truck seated and the expense of unseated equipment, right? And that constantly changing. And so one of the things that happens at a big carriers, I've worked for some big ones. The RFP season, as we used to call it, is very unsophisticated.
Oh, yeah.
And so what happens is all these salespeople are calling these shippers and it's RFP season and it goes to, you know, Sue's desk or maybe a yield manager or a pricing person, and it's furiously downloading sheets and then everybody putting into their crystal ball what they think might happen. And you've got carriers trying to make major budget decisions around this. How many more trailers do I go lease? How many drivers do I hire? Am I going to get the freight that I've been hauling for 5, 6, 7 years? Or could it be taken from me by a digital that's willing to lose money? I mean, there's all of these questions. Like I said at the beginning, I have more questions than I have answers. I just think that, and I don't know what the data is, right? Because Dean and I were talking yesterday, and there's not one data point. You can't look at just tender rejections, and you can't just look at the kind of the sliver of data that DAT has in the spot market. I mean, there's factoring company data. There's, like you brought up something about ingots in China. What is the answer? I don't know, but I think that it's definitely got to be more of a collaborative process because it's expensive. It costs everybody a tremendous amount of time and money to get what? To benchmark your incumbent and just go back to your incumbent and say, five new guys want your freight and you got to match this rate if you want to keep it. You know, statistically, incumbents don't lose business, right, Dean?
Right, exactly. I mean, there's another layer to this, and Ron's exactly right. But if you think about it, the procurement process is fairly static, and what we're trying to do is model the procurement process on an industry that's very dynamic. So there's a mismatch between the two. Yep. So if you go through this, you know, the average procurement in our world is about 16 weeks. The average process from planning right through to the awarding of the tender. And the problem is that I think it's a technology gap as much as it is anything. I agree you need the shippers certainly need to understand, and I think they do, but there's actually a physical limitation because if you think about the current route planning technology, it's software it's like planning tools that sit on top of sophisticated optimization engines that you can put in hard constraints, you know, like limit the number of carriers on a lane or award a certain percentage of volume on a certain lane to a carrier, those sorts of things. So there's a lot of modeling and optimization that goes into it. And then we have this fairly rudimentary award process, tendering process using EDI within the TMS that offers very little ability to ingest all of that intellectual property that went into the allocation of an award to a carrier on a lane. So I think even if we wanted to, the current design of the process from award to tendering in this two-stage process is really, really limiting. It's a bit like, you know, the route planning and optimization is like using a scalpel, and the TMS EDI process is like using an axe. That's sort of that's how I look at the two.
Mm-hmm. And then you end up in these compliance discussions, right?
Right.
So it's no longer about this partnership or this trust, but it's like there's a scorecard and there's a compliance thing, and you're just getting this black and white,
right?
You're good or you're bad because you did or didn't accept a tender. Look, I've gotten 20 loads a week awarded before, and they tender me 19 on a Sunday after 3.
Right.
Like, time.
Well, you get
not exactly what we talked about.
Right.
Yeah. Do what?
You get the ghost lanes, right? Where the what was forecast and allocated just doesn't materialize.
Correct.
At all. Yeah, so.
I love we're Daniel Stanton's comment, by the way. Well, it's hard to forecast in this industry. Like, okay, so Dean, Dean or Michael or Ron. So I know that Ron probably is there when you're going through this manual process and your team is getting tied up looking at these Excel spreadsheets. Somebody's like, there's got to be data out in the market. There's got to be reports we can just buy that tell us what's the rates. What are these lanes? I mean, they're not the answer, but they at least get you into the ballpark, or they at least give you a thumb on the pulse. Is there a one resource? And Dean, you work for DAT, so I don't, you know, your response can be a little one sided. But does your company offer something, or Michael, what are the options?
Yeah, go ahead, we forecast rates out to 52 weeks, but you know, and of course, when you get out that far, anything can happen. But right. Forecasting around 14 to 35 days is pretty accurate. It's up around 95% accuracy. So there are tools out there that you can develop a fair bit of certainty around which direction rates are heading. But I would say, in addition to that, you've got to look at all of the other things that drive capacity, supply and demand. So we take, for example, 2020. You know, they introduced the Drug and Alcohol Clearinghouse at the worst possible time, January 6th, right? And then the pandemic hits. And then suddenly of the 60,000 drivers that got caught for drug and alcohol violations, 50,000 have elected not to go through the rehab process. So in 2020, on top of, even if you are planning with the best forecasting tools, there are things that happen that you have to be aware of, because that's physically constrained the supply of drivers through schools, and training schools were hit hard because they're either closed down or at best operating at minimal capacity. So the actual supply of new drivers into the industry was cramped, if not shut down completely for a period of time. And that's why capacity tightened, and that's why rates increased, amongst a number of other things. But that was a pretty significant factor that shippers should have been aware of and factoring into their modelling somehow. I'm not sure it was. Maybe Ron can speak to that. But that was a pretty obvious thing that was happening in the middle of last year from a supply perspective.
From a data perspective, Cassandra, I don't think there's any one point. And I think one of the problems is that people try to pick a point and get caught on it,
right?
And they stop running their business, whether there's a shipper or a carrier or whatever, right? And so one of the things that I've seen happen, I have some friends that work in procurement at pretty big 3PLs, right? And they'll get told to go to market. Routing guide can be fine, they can be on budget, but somebody, not somebody in Ron's seat, but somebody will decide that there's some meat on the bone. And so the 3PL, the big 3PL, not like me, the little broker, but like, needs to go to market and see what they can do, right? And I don't know, and nobody knows where the data came from, right? And so within a big 3PL is a really good example when you have a front row seat, because within those four walls, you may have, like Ron, you used to do Monster, right? Didn't you used to procure from Monster? So food grade trailers, different kind of network, different kind of fines from a retailer, very different than buying, you know, for an oilfield company, like van loads for Exxon lubricants or chemicals. Like, just like Ron, if you ran those networks, it's two completely different things, right? Two completely different buying cycles. So you can't just pull down some supply and demand numbers and some pricing numbers and go, well, there's my benchmark. Mm-hmm. Like, if you look at factor data, the rates are different between commodity categories. And so I don't think it's as simple as let's go get this data point and say what it should be. I think it is fair for every shipper to look at their network and look at their carrier base and say, how do we plan for this to move? How do we plan for the unplanned?
Yep.
Right? Knowing that that you can look at any carrier's operating ratio and see how thin it is and understand that cash flow is a huge issue, and that having an arbitrary compliance discussion when there really are market changes is never going to be profitable for a carrier. Now, the flip side is the carrier has to turn around and say, you want some money back, Mr. Shipper? Hey, Ron, you played ball when it got hard. Here's my rate concession. And to your point, Dean, about how it's tendered and tracked, it's very rudimentary. There's no room for a conversation like that in most typical post-RFP implementation things. So again, I've stated another problem with zero resolution, but Ron, feel happy to talk about it.
No, actually, you brought something. It's funny because you talk about there's not a specific data point. I completely agree with you. I will also say that by and large, talking to carriers, brokers, for the most part, there's very little ability to tell the story that the data is leading them to. Most of the time, and I've said this before too on here and other times, the favorite line for two decades has been driver shortage. Like, got it. Whether it's real or fake, whatever it is, I'm tired of talking about it. Bring data. Let's talk about what that means to me as a network and me as a provider, how I can work with you as a shipper to achieve the goals of the entire network. And very, very few brokers and carriers walk into an RFP or even a sales call with the story, because the story is what matters. The story is what helps you and I connect to see if we can push our businesses together. You're right. There is no one data point. And one data point for you might mean nothing to me, whereas it might, the other data point is completely important to me. You know, it's where you mentioned I was in beer with reefer, van loads with Monster, now completely flatbed, three completely different things, three different data points. I need to understand the stories that we work together to come together for a bid, or what is the right one, a proposal for business to connect so that we can both be successful. And, you know, you talked about concessions. Both of us are horrible at doing that. You know, shippers fight when the rates go up, and you know, the CFO's yelling at me, so I'm calling you going, what the hell's going on? But then when it softens, you know, it's the, you know, we all see the publicly traded transportation companies talking about 33% improvements on bottom line. And we're like, yeah, that's out of my pocket. So how do we make that? That's where I think, how do we make, how does the story connect us so that we honestly do work as business partners for, frankly, more than one bid cycle? Because if we're only talking one bid cycle, that's, I'm sorry, that's prostitution. You know, we've got to build a relationship.
Well, so the other thing too, I think to consider is like what is the answer? So Ron, when, you know, when we're all at TIA or TCA and we're all sitting around the bar bitching about you, what are you and all your shipper buddies? You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, the shippers are all out to get us. But what's the best practice approach, right? Like how does that conversation, because in my mind, if there's a driver shortage, I don't know if there is, I don't know if there's a driver shortage. I don't know if there's a driver pay problem.
Yep.
I think anytime you have some of the working conditions that we ask drivers to work in, it's going to be hard to maybe attract younger talent into that pool. I had a talk with a guy that's done some consulting that used to be at what, in my opinion, was one of the worst shippers in North America. You know, they would hold you up to these incredible SLAs because of these SLAs that they had with Home Depot. But then when they went to unload you at your own facility, they'd sit you on the street for 5 hours, 6 hours, 10 hours at a time. Had to rebuild his solution 3-4 times.
Right? Yep.
So he wants to ask for this high SLA on one side. And that you can't look at a spreadsheet with an origin destination pair and tell that story.
Right.
So I would say, you know, you're saying, like, the shipper, from the shipper saying, you're saying, hey, Mr. Carrier, Mr. Broker, walk in and tell me a story and let's kind of get endeared to one another. Mm. But like, when does the shipper look across the table and go, I'm gonna be real honest with you, my stuff sucks sometimes. And so when I kill your hours of service and I cost you $550, $750 of a day's revenue, I know it sucks. I'm working on it. How do you get there? Like when shippers have this conversation, is there any talk about a best practice approach to procurement in whatever the new world is?
No, way too infrequently. And I think it's a great question. I think the problem is what you just described. Ultimately, we pay the bills, so we can be as shitty as we want to be, because the one thing that helps us, there's too many carriers and the barrier entry is too low that it doesn't matter how shitty I am, somebody somewhere will carry my shitty load and they'll do it and I can push it down. And until that changes, but that's realistically, because the fact that that happens, it's really tough to start to hold each other accountable, because I got to go grab that load versus, because I completely agree with you. I've built a career focused on truly focusing on being a shipper of choice, trying to make that work. Because I agree, it only works if we build these long-term relationships. Yeah. But I've worked in places and I've been to places to where the attitude is, frankly, fuck the driver. I don't care. If he doesn't pick it up, I can grab somebody else. There's three letter brokers that I can call. They'll send somebody in here. It'll move. I don't really have to care. I've also been in conversations with executives who have talked about the $50,000 maybe to make just a good driver's room, you know, with some vending machines and access to a bathroom. The ROI is too low. We're not going to do that. It's like, you know, these are people. You know, so how do you change that? I think collectively, everybody raising the bars on what's to be expected. But the fact is, there's a hell of a lot of shippers and a whole lot of carriers. And that math means that it's pretty easy to find shitty partners that are going to keep working together.
But, you know, I think a couple of things, Eric. One, can you keep having these conversations out and in as many forums as possible and saying, how do you make the driver's life better? As much time as we spend trying to screw each other on line items on an RFP, right? Like if we spent more time, so we're building there's a company in Savannah building a 1 million-square-foot facility. And I said, so what are we doing about driver lounge? And so it was a really good conversation. And, you know, one of the conversations was, if you want to be a shipper of choice, employer of choice, have the most comfortable place for someone to be if they have to wait, right? If they're coming in and like, just like, and that doesn't cost ROI my ass. That doesn't cost anything. Mm-hmm. That's like paint and some vending machines and being nice. Right. Except it costs for nothing liability. To be nice. Right. But I think
it does cost liability though, wise Michael. Like I think that Imran and I had this discussion once. I know it's a lawyer coming in because I wouldn't want drivers on my property.
Son of the lawyer.
I know because first of all, I've been involved where drivers have gotten invites on the property, where there's been slipping falls, where there's been nonsense. So we having people on our property on is like you get them off. So there is a cost in that way. I just wanted to point that out because I can't help it because I'm a lawyer and it just comes up.
Yeah.
Amanda Miller asked a question. She escalated. I think she's escalated a question, but it's a really good one that I've actually thought about too for Ron and anybody in their experience, which is if you send an RFP to someone, would you rather them fill out every lane or fill out the lanes they're confident in covering? And then Ron, I'm going to throw something on top of it, which is, y'all have those tabs, all tons of tabs, all these fucking questions about like claims ratio and financial stability of the company. Tell us your life story. Do you guys actually look at that? Like, tell us the inner workings a little bit on this. And Michael, I'm sorry if I'm going a little bit astray from your agenda. I know that you had a really cool agenda, but I'm curious because I've seen these a lot and always wondered, is it just bullshit? Should I just blow through it?
No, actually, to Amanda's question, not speaking to myself personally, but I think generally most shippers would say fill them all out, but most shippers use all the data as trying to figure out the cost for somebody outside of the management. For me, wanting to manage it, I just want to know what you're going to cover. That's what I want to look at. As far as all the other tabs, I think that this is where it's important. I talked about the fact that this service, transportation, is treated completely different within organizations for whatever reason, and it's evolved that way. As a transportation person, all those tabs are going to somebody else, you know. So you're dealing with your insurance group, your compliance group, your finance group. In some cases, it's going to go and talk about quarterly results because they're going to roll it up and say, this is what's going on in the industry. So every single knucklehead inside of an organization that can have a question about transportation gets a tab. And it doesn't matter what knucklehead asks the question, that tab gets created because eventually during the bid, you got to get their question answered. And it's big, it's unwieldy. And I hate to say it because without there being a consistent approach for all companies, you guys as carriers or brokers, you get 1,000 different versions from everybody because it doesn't matter. It's what's important. You know, I care about, does my ice cream not freeze on Tuesday? And that's where, can you give me the guarantee on what your reefer carries at on Tuesday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? And I create a tab for it. So it sucks. I'm not going to deny it.
With the other departments analyzing the certain tabs, how much, and obviously not talking about your current employer or any specific employer in general, and all your experience, how much do they use it as an analysis to report back, or do they actually say, hey, Ron, these top providers that you've analyzed for rates and that you like, we don't like them because of this, this, and this, or we do like them because of this, this, and this. Is it a collaboration or is it independent? I guess
usually it's assuming well run, and by well run, I mean better than mediocre company, you know, folks that know what they're doing, their checks. You know, and that's okay. I'm not minimizing a check, but it's okay. Yep, the insurance is here. Yes, they're doing this. Yes, they're doing this. And they'll typically put together a non-compliant sheet on, hey, these carriers can't meet whatever my criteria is. And usually done well, it's a, hey, can you go back and ask? versus that just get rid of. You know, so it's okay. Hey, somebody might have missed it. I know this is kind of sloppy. So, you know, but this, all this stuff typically gets done once. You know, all those other tabs, that's really you as a new carrier. Once you're going through a standard RFP and you're part of the network, you're not redoing that stuff unless something changes dramatically outbound. You know, so all of a sudden I'm going outbound Florida, outbound Maine, and there's different state rules about different things I might have to ask about because I'm a California-based shipper. But once I've got those things in my database, it's pretty cut and dry and clean. So I recognize first-time new carrier, that sucks. But it's only going to suck once.
Okay. One more question for you, which is, because I'm an evil lawyer. Evil lawyer Cassandra, which does not exist, would be like, yeah, fucking just disqualify half of that stuff. Claims ratios, all the stuff that they're not going to be able to verify. Just go through and make us look fantastic. Do you account for the glorification, or do you guys double check? Like, what is that? Is that ever in your mind? Because half of that stuff, I'm like, there's no fucking way they can verify it. So we're going to beef this up. That's what I think in my head. Cassandra would never do that.
No, you verify what you can verify, but I guess I'm a believer in, you use the term bottom feeders, people that glorify and ultimately are shitty, they get figured out at some point. And sometimes they get figured out in a bad way because something bad happens. But most of the time, it's the little things that trip you up, because then you start asking the questions and it's like, wait, you don't have that? So it's, I guess I'll call it annoying, but not hugely disruptive. It's just part of the day to day, and you figure it out and you move on, because it'll eventually get caught out.
Yeah, Cassandra, you're talking about, Michael, I had to take you on down the rabbit hole.
You talk about the tabs of the data. So here, I'm going to just like, there's some companies that have these really great pricing and yield departments, and they use a bunch of language and they have a bunch of spreadsheets, and they're really great. When I say companies, I mean like big brokers and motor carriers.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also tell you that most large companies, the sales guys do in your RFP.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's like a Friday and it's like, okay, we got to do RFPs. We're going to have a jam session after work. Everybody,
we're
going to sort all of, you know, the Southeast. You guys bid all the Southeast. And so what I would tell you is, if you're a shipper and you're listening to this, most of the data you get is okay.
Especially unless it's like a carrier's like core, certain amount of revenue.
Like core length. Most of the data you get is kind of like, and we're all trying to figure out how to cover it if you award it. Even a trucking company. So I'm gonna pitch it to Dean for a little bit of data, because if you're a shipper, like I just want you to think critically about something. Especially the shippers that love to talk about asset-based carriers.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that mostly the truckload market is small carriers that have turnover of like 90%. So you're talking about lots of lease purchase drivers, you're talking about people that move around all the time. So the reality is that these asset-based carriers, all these shippers, want reflected in their RFP so that they look good when they have to go talk to Cassandra, their lawyer. The drivers are moving around. These carriers have very little control. Mm-hmm. And most motor carriers are looking, trying to plan for their network. And just like a broker, they're trying to figure out how the hell they're going to cover it if you award it. And if they get awarded a whole bunch of freight, or if they lose a whole bunch of freight, they have to get their recruiters to start, we need 20 drivers that are domiciled in North Carolina because we want all this freight, or we want all this freight, but we didn't get the backhaul over here. And so sales, you've got to go over here and get a bunch of broker freight. So just think about the fact that when you have a three to six month cycle for your RFP, everything in that carrier is changing. This isn't just a broker problem. Mm. This is a carrier figuring out how they're going to actually execute.
Right.
Dean, can I have some data?
Well, yeah, average detention time or dwell time in a dock is about 52 minutes at the moment. It's there's a positive correlation. The longer length of haul, the longer the wait time. And I think in the post-ELD era, a lot of this has become a pretty big issue, because drivers quit because they get, you know, held up waiting on loading docks and things like that. For a driver that's, you know, and for some reason the motor carriers have given shippers a couple of hours to unload a trailer. But for a driver in the ELD era, they can no longer play catch up on all of the inefficiencies at the dock. Now,
wait, what do you mean by catch up?
Well, paper logs you could.
Come on, Dean. That was a very nice word. I'm a lawyer.
I call it creative bookkeeping is the technical.
Yes, I call it not following the law for all the carriers listening. Okay, go ahead, Dean. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, so that was the reality, and that's part of the reason it was okay, because you could log off duty and then whatever you loaded me, I couldn't care less. I'd have a sleep, right? And then, of course, now in the post-TLD era, we have to be online.
They got to follow the law.
Driving, blah, blah, blah. Doesn't mean we're any safer, because you can be 100% compliant and sound asleep at the wheel at the same time. Don't forget that. So for a driver, though, 1 hour sitting on a loading dock is an opportunity cost of $20. They're not because they've only got 60 hours to run in a week. So for every hour they sit on a dock not being paid, for them it's less rolling time, and that costs them money, and that affects their paycheck. And when you think about the cost of a new hire is somewhere between $5,000 and $8,000 per new to reseat a truck, that cost eventually rolls up into the bid, and I don't ever see the connection between the RFP, the rate on that lane, and the actual cost to run that truck. That's where I see a big disconnect. I'm sure I answered your question.
But do you think the carrier even knows, Dean? Do you think most carriers even understand how to make that cost equation?
Some do. So the ones with telematics that use telematics have good relationships with their shippers and use data in the negotiation process. Absolutely. But I don't know how much that is used. I think it's less frequent than most people think.
I have a very important question to ask, Dean. Mm-hmm. When you're sitting down at dinner with your wife or your sons, your two sons who are out at the clubs right now, because you've been vaccinated, do you ever just talk about data at work and they're like, holy shit, what did he just say?
Yeah, I do.
My son, like, my dad's a nerd.
They did. My son said, he said that. He said, Dad, you're talking to the neighbor about the Suez Canal and how many ships are tied up. Said, what's wrong with you? This is on Sunday morning. I said, I was just trying to be friendly.
Yeah.
He said, you're such a nerd. Yeah.
And I've known Dean for a little bit, for a bit. And like, he'll pull some shit out of the esoteric. And you're like, Dean, I don't.
Dean, how do you know that? What did you just say? What did, like, that even mean?
Traffic camera. You're like, Dean, how do you know that? Like, when do you read this? Like, where does that come from?
That's the sponge.
He gave us some crazy that one time on kangaroos getting run over by 18-wheelers. I don't know. It's evidently a problem. It is, you know, yeah, no.
Wait, they do get run over by 18-wheelers?
Oh, I'd hit half a dozen a night in the outback.
Kangaroos.
Kangaroos are like deer. They're in epic plague proportions in the outback. So, yeah. They compete for water and grass, and it's one of our bigger exports is wool, which come off sheep, and so they're a problem. And the problem is they like the warm blacktop at night.
Water and some grass, Dean?
See what I mean? You gotta be careful what you bring up.
I've never been late for a load. I would never stop for a kangaroo. Maybe a camel. I would stop for a camel, but not a kangaroo. They're getting hit.
They're cute little kangaroos.
They bounce off.
You know the babies? The babies are in their little pouches, you still hit a
kangaroo.
I thought you were nice. Maybe there is a reason why you're a Red Sox fan and a Patriots fan. Like, you're cutthroat.
Yeah.
Don't let the accent fool you.
But
okay.
So, Ron, so, I have one question.
Can you tell us the camera thing real quick? Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Talk about the cameras yesterday. What was
the
that
camera thing
you had? About traffic cams and congestion and something you brought up yesterday that drove up costs. We were talking about all the random, the thousand things that drive costs up.
Yeah, so I use the data from the Federal Highway Administration, where they have these passive roadside counters that measure cars and truck traffic across our interstate highways. And it's really interesting data. It passes out trucks and cars. So year over year, weekly mileage this week, trucks are up about 8% more miles this week than the same week last year, right? So drivers are doing more miles on the interstates. But during the polar vortex, we went from being 8% up year over year at the start of February to 5% down. So in that 1 week, we lost about 7% of capacity. And if you looked at the interstates, you saw trucks all pulled up everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I computed that to be about 108 million miles of capacity that just vanished off the roads that week. And, of course, the prior 2 weeks, you had all this cold weather, lots of protect from freeze, added to dry van loads for freight that might normally freeze when it got really cold at the start of February. Polar vortex hit. Trucks were literally stopped on the road. Again, post-ELD era, a lot of them ran out of arrows. I had to take a 34-hour restart mid-trip, and then they're all off their cycle in terms of the networks. So in that 1 week, we lost so much capacity, spot rates took about 3 weeks before they've started the plateau. So, again, another data point, but to me it explains a lot of what's happened in the last couple of weeks.
But all these data points, Dean, are rocks in a pond, right? Like, it's like dropping a rock in a pond. Like,
well, it's like I look at it like a jigsaw puzzle, right? Because to get the full picture, you've got to have all the pieces together. Because no one piece on its own tells the full story. That's how I look at it.
So, but Ron, you talk about telling the story. So when I start missing your freight, you're like, I don't give shit about some polar vortex on the other side of the country. Are you going to pick my stuff up or not? Like, how do you want someone to have that conversation with you?
I want somebody to be incredibly honest about what's going on. And if it is an exception,
unpredictable, like a polar vortex, go ahead.
It is exceptional that it only happens. So if you are talking to me about missing my freight on a regular basis, not a polar vortex, those are two very different conversations. And that's where the story to me matters. And it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's like anything, you know, your favorite Taco Bell is going to fuck up at one point too, but it doesn't mean you stop eating.
Taco Bell doesn't fuck up. They just don't. I've never experienced it. But Ron, wouldn't it be cool if you had somebody who knew a storm was coming and gave you a heads up? If we get hit with a storm, blah, 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 blah. Have you had that in your experience?
I've worked with carriers that are very, very, very good at that, that know what's going on in a network and seeing stuff happening. And being able to say, this might impact you over here, but more important, not just this might impact you over here. This is what we're doing to try to mitigate the overall impact. You're still going to see something. We're pushing ahead to try to make sure that you see a little bit less of what you would see, but I'm letting you know up front that most don't do it. And frankly, equally, shippers don't do a really good job when we talk about the fact that the warehouse might be screwed up and it's going to toast you when you come to pick up. Mm-hmm. So this is, I'm not sitting on a royal throne over here. I know that we can screw things up pretty damn easily as well.
I think those are good points. What I was really trying to tease out more than anything is that there's a lot of nuances in this, right?
Yeah.
People have quality issues at a plant that change things that are going to affect a driver waiting, right? Carriers have issues where, look, we had a deal one time where we won a ton of freight from a really, really big, like, beverage company out of the Northeast, really big. And all of our inbound freight that we've been hauling for 15 years, they closed the plant that produced all that inbound freight. And 1 week post award, and this was asset freight. This wasn't like a broker play. I had to call and say, I'm no longer sending 50 trucks a week there. Like, it's literally not that. Like, I literally don't have the inbound freight, and I can't put together enough. It was all drop and hook, trailer pool.
Yeah.
Right. So sometimes, like, things like that, like, legitimately happen. A plant will close. Something will change. Like. And there are these major ripples that happen. And so when we talk about RFPs and are they effective, I think the problem with RFPs is that RFPs often don't facilitate a conversation. Yeah. I wish they did, right? And that's why I think you're a bad example, Ron, because you're too damn reasonable. But for the most part,
I know, we have like a really bad shipper on here. We could be like,
you can't get to them. I mean, I've done thousands of these exercises. And it's like, hey, what am I bidding? Hey, what really drives cost out of your supply chain? Not rate per mile, but like, what are you looking to accomplish at the end of this exercise before you do awards? And rarely can you get to people, Ron. Like, rarely can you get to somebody that's willing to have that conversation with you. They just want to push you to the business analyst or push you into the process, push you into the tabs on a spreadsheet. It's very difficult sometimes. I understand it's an ideal state, but so...
Sorry, Dean. Go on.
No, I was actually going to say, I guess I'm thinking about it from a different way. You're right. It gets pushed. But I guess maybe that there's an opportunity that if you're a better carrier or better broker and you can tell the story what stops you from telling the story, even if nobody's listening? Because there is at least an opportunity for somebody maybe to hear a snippet of it, and then it becomes the opportunity to listen. And I think, honestly, because I've joined organizations where we did shitty RFPs. We did exactly what you just described. Some suppliers are better at telling the story, recognizing that maybe nobody's there to hear it, but I'm just hoping. And those are the ones, and the way I operate, I recognize is a little bit different from what a lot are, but I do think that, you know, maybe I tend to think there's more good in the world. If you've got a good story, you know, to your point about that plant, you know, this is how I'm able to service it. If you're able to talk to it, you might not get a lot of folks to listen, but if you get 5% to listen to the first year and that business grows to 10%, 15%, you know, and I absolutely, I recognize this is, you know, a little, you know, too much utopia, and that's not necessarily what the real world is. But I think that if you want to work with shippers that think the way I operate, you have to assume there's somebody there that'll listen to what you got to tell, recognizing that statistically, you might not hit on very many of them because it's just not true. But even if you get one, can one become three, can become eight, can become 20? Yeah. And that's the way I would look at it if I was a carrier, that hope you hit the one person that's going to listen to what your story is about, why your network is what it is, and can listen to Dean's data and go, yeah, that makes some sense. And you know, I don't want to ride this. I want to ride this, that we're both happy and, you know, you're profitable and you're safe and you're growing your network and I'm comfortable talking to my CFO. So that's the way I look at it. But I also recognize that, you know, that's still a lot of numbers that you got to deal with.
Yeah. Dean, if you're a carrier, or a broker, and you're looking for data to validate that story, rate data is a lagging indicator, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Skippy. That's Skippy. Skippy the bush kangaroo.
If rate data is a lagging indicator, I can't deal with this little guy staring.
Why do you do that?
If rate data is a lagging indicator, what should providers be looking for upstream from rate data to be able to tell a compelling story about their own network?
Yep. At a commodity level, I'll give you an example with flatbeds. I look at building permits and new home starts, single family starts. I look at number of combine harvesters, over 400 horsepower tractors being manufactured, what those numbers are monthly. That tells me how many drop decks I'm going to need with outriggers, for example, in a market. I look at import numbers into Baltimore from overseas, the number of pounds of ro-ro machines being dropped on that port, same as Houston. So if I was a flatbed operator with drop decks and specialized gear, I would look at some things that tell me, is it improving, getting better, getting worse, is it stable? So I look at all of those sort of demand drivers as far out as I can to get a better picture so I can put some context around where I am today and what decisions I need to make.
We have 1 minute left. I would like to say that Andrew Teal, I'm gonna kick your ass, Andrew Teal. Can't believe you just said that. Andrew Teal is bashing. He's just horrible. I need to throw him off the show. He's a troll. Ron, I have a question for you to wrap this up. When you're going through the RFP process, was there anything that you, any resource that you were like, this is a waste of time for my entire team? I'm not fishing. I'm just like, I'm still kind of baffled that we're doing this manual process with Excel sheets and there's nothing else in the industry. Yeah, there's some tool over here and there's tool over here. DAT, we have DAT because we love Dean and we love fucking kangaroos. But isn't there a better alternative? Michael, Ron, Dean, anything?
Yeah, I get
to doing all these independent assessments. Go ahead.
I've owned a couple of trucking companies and some large, you know, we had some $10 million contracts in Australia. So very different, you know, small scale model of this country. But the customers we worked with, we always were a solution provider, not just transactional. So we would always design equipment around what they needed, so that, you know, for example, one customer said, I've got a problem. We run empty one way on toilet paper, but then the tanker that brings in the acid that bleeds the pulp runs empty the other. So we said, well, we'll just build a flatbed with a tank under it. But what we need, though, is telemetry. We need the tank levels in our office, in our truck business, so we know how much acid to bring in. And then we need the integration with the WMS to know how much toilet paper to ship out so we can have the right balance. So we reduce their transportation costs and increased our loaded rate per mile. So I've only ever worked as a solution provider, and brokers and carriers can do that, and they don't have to be as transactional. But maybe that's utopia, as Ron mentioned. Maybe that's just something you can only do with small accounts and small shippers and carriers. I'm not sure that works at scale, though.
I think you can do it. I think I could go to Ron and go, Ron, you've got a $40 million spend. I'm only interested in the $7 million, but I'll own it and I'll execute it. And can what does it take to take that $7 million off the table?
Right.
What do you need from me? Yeah. So I think you can have those conversations.
Yep.
My hope is that at some point in the future, there is a, you know, whether it's a you know, like what K ratio is trying to do or somebody like that, that there's an index that we can all look at and go, yeah, I see it moved. Mm-hmm. Either if it's region, commodity, but like my hope is that there at some point is an unbiased third party data driven that kind of brings people to the table around a conversation. Because you know, Dean, I don't know if a bunch of flatbed carriers have to go time to go look at like combine manufacturing. I just don't know that everybody's gonna get off of this show and be like, damn it, gotta get the combine report. So somebody has to do something, right? To facilitate that, right, Ron? I mean somebody's gotta do that.
Completely agree.
Okay. So I think we've had a great discussion today. Oh, okay. Of course, Zeke puts up Andrew Thiel's comment about it's a great discussion today. So if Andrew says it's a great discussion, I'm going to keep drinking. And my grandma's phone's back there, like John had said. And thank you, Fink and Daniel Stanton and Tremble for joining. And we have Peter. And we have some random Pink Panther. We have a lot of people in this crowd that need to go away. Ron, thank you for joining us again. I owe you big time. Michael, thank you for co-hosting. Dean, I'm like back and forth because your mind is brilliant and I like the accent and I like you. I don't like you're a Red Sox fan. I don't like you're a Patriots fan. And I don't know about the kangaroo murdering thing.
Like, sorry.
That's hardcore.
Never late for a load.
Hardcore, Dean.
Always on time.
God, don't listen to Dean. Thank you to our sponsors, OTR Capital. Thank you, JJ Keller. And I will let you guys all get drunk and